Can somebody tell me where we are? My book is a very old edition. You know, I can tell you what paragraph, but I need to know what page. It's our conception of the infinite is formlessness.
I have the big blue book, and it's the top of 354.
Okay. So
I have an edition on 337. That paragraph, our conception.
Yeah, wherever you have it, it's the paragraph beginning, our conception of the infinite is formlessness. And at this part in the text, Sri Aurobindo is taking us through a number of opposites, of dualities. And prior to this, he has fielded that paradoxical nature of our phenomenal experience. He has pointed out, because he's making the case for a reality which is absolute, he is pointing out that in our phenomenal experience, we experience a set of dualities. And if we go by the power of our external mind, then these dualities seem to be absolute. This is arising because what he's calling the external mind is tied to the senses. And this sense experience is giving us the evidence of a world of separate finites, a finite world. So from the viewpoint of that finite experience, we come up with a number of opposites. The primary one being the opposition of the infinite and the finite. Now, this is actually normal. I mean, we can consider it to be something logical, since in the domain of the finite, one is an instance. If we say there is one, we are actually talking about one among others. And so this kind of experience of one, the unitary reality as an instance, is automatically in opposition to the notion of infinity. Infinity seems to be a radical plurality, and we can think of it as many ones. On the other hand, if we think about a one, which is infinite, something which is the only thing there is, which is what he's starting with, only way we can make sense of this reality is to talk about the self-multiplication of the one, which never changes as a result of that. Hence, we can talk of about it as an infinite one. Immediately, we are pushed into a different domain. It cannot remain the same domain as the domain of the finite. So this basic opposition leads to a number of other oppositions in our phenomenal experience. But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out is that simultaneously with this sensory experience of absolute separation, domain of finites, we also experience the one, because ultimately it is the one that lives in us. The infinite one that lives in us, or that has become this world of infinite finites. So with that assumption, Sri Aurobindo is pointing out the various oppositions that we experience, and showing how each of these oppositions ultimately is a false opposition. It's a duality that is at one level a complementarity, a kind of integrated polarity, two ends of a spectrum that has a range in between, and also as a dual appearance of the same, for manifesting the conditions of both finiteness and infinity. So this way he has taken us through reconsideration of the indeterminable and the determinate. He has taken us through that which has infinite qualities and is bereft of all qualities, and he has taken us through the one and the many. The last chapter that we complete, or paragraph that we completed, he took us through the stillness and the movement. That's what we finished on the 14th. And now we come to our conception of the infinite, where he is fielding the duality or opposition between formlessness and form. So I think at that point, at this point, we can start reading, unless anybody has any questions and comments to make of, about what has transpired so far.
May I ask if this term formlessness, what word would be used in Sanskrit for the word formless here?
Good question. So there's a number of terms that are used. For example, in Buddhism, the form arup is used, arupa. So rupa, which means form, and arupa is that which the negation of form, formless. In Hinduism, I can't think offhand what term is used. There's a number of terms that are used. Anybody else has a perspective on that? What do you think, Justin? Do you remember any such term yourself?
Arupa, to me, sounds like, if I think of the Yoga Sutra, that would be the word. Perhaps alinga, not marked, but...
Yeah,
but
not without any sign. Alinga would be unsigned, or significance, bereft of significance, outside of the domain of signs.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, yeah, there are other terms that are more common in the Hindu literature. I'll think about it next time. We can, I can let you know. So, Justin, would you like to read that paragraph, Our Conception of the Infinite?
Okay. Thank you. Our conception of the infinite is formlessness. But everywhere we see form and forms surrounding us, and it can be and is affirmed of the divine being that he is at once form and formless. For here too the apparent contradiction does not correspond to a real opposition. The formless is not a negation of the power of formation, but the condition for the infinite's free formation. For otherwise, there would be a single form, or only a fixity or sum of possible forms in a finite universe. The formlessness is the character of the spiritual essence, the spirit substance of the reality. All finite realities are powers, forms, self-shapings of that substance. The divine is formless and nameless, but by that very reason, capable of manifesting all possible names and shapes of being. Forms are manifestations, not arbitrary inventions out of nothing. For line and color, mass and design, which are the essentials of form, carry always in them a significance, are, it might be said, secret values and significances of an unseen reality made visible. It is for that reason that figure, line, hue, mass, composition can embody what would otherwise be unseen, can convey what would otherwise be occult to the sense, form may be said to be the innate body, the inevitable self-revelation of the formless. And this is true not only of external shapes, but of the unseen formations of mind and life, which we seize only by our thought, and those sensible forms of which only the subtle grasp of an inner consciousness can become aware. Name, in its deeper sense, is not the word by which we describe the object, but the total of power, quality, character of the reality which a form of things embodies, and which we try to sum up by a designating sound, a knowable name, nomen. Nomen, in this sense, we might say is noumen, the secret names of the gods are their power, quality, character of being caught up by the consciousness and made conceivable. The infinite is nameless, but in that namelessness, all possible names, noumens of the gods, the names and the forms of all realities are already envisaged and prefigured because they are the latent and inherent in the all existence.
So, as we can see here, he takes up this duality of the formless and of form. And he's making the point that, again, that there is a certain kind of infinity to the number of forms and the kinds of forms that can belong to reality. And hence, the absolute must be without any particular defined form. So this in a way is a validation of what one might call monotheistic schools that are aniconic. But then he turns around at the same, you know, kind of time and says that that is only the condition for the divine's assumption of an infinite number of forms. In other words, form and formlessness coexist. And we find that in the Indian tradition, we find two kinds of references to this. One is that of, the being who presents himself in a certain form, but has the ability to change that form at will. And this infinity is referred to in certain traditions which are mostly theistic, because when we are talking about form, we are talking about person that takes a certain type of form. And if the Supreme Divine presents itself in a form, that form cannot but be an infinite form. In other words, it's a form that is a front for infinite qualities to modulate themselves and make themselves visible. So we are told that in Vaishnava traditions, for example, where Krishna is the center of the cult, we are told that the Brahman, the impersonal and formless Brahman, is the aura of Krishna. By aura is meant the fact that that is what sustains his reality, but his center and self, ultimate self, is his form. So there are traditions that have privileged form, but they haven't done so at the cost of the formless. The formless remains like the what he calls the noumen, and that's why Sri Aurobindo ends this paragraph by contrasting the noumen and the noumen. The noumen, the idea behind it, is infinite. The noumen, the name, is something which signifies that infinity. So we find that in this way there is a certain kind of double thinking, so that one does not privilege an iconism or iconism. Iconism is where one builds a cult around a single form and attributes to that the totality of the divine. So what is being said is that if any such form of the divine exists, it coexists with its own infinity, its formless infinity. And that's why he says over here, here too the apparent contradiction does not correspond to a real opposition. The formless is not a negation of the power of formation, but the condition for the infinite's free formation. For otherwise there would be a single form, or only a fixity or sum of possible forms in a finite universe. So this, you know, this absence of form is not an absence. It's a plenitude, an overflowing plenitude of infinite forms. And then he moves on and talks about forms in terms which one can think of as artistic, where he speaks about the significance of forms and their character. What are the various characteristics of form? He's talking about line, color, mass, and design, which are all significant features that carry in form certain ideas. And again, he talks about figure, line, hue, mass, and composition. And these are making visible and putting into a certain kind of shape or finite appearance certain truths of the spirit, certain qualities or combinations of qualities that would otherwise remain occult to the sense, as he says. So this is how he points out that the infinite one self-manifests its own properties in a variety of appearances. And these appearances are not merely of the body, of the form in that sense. And that's why I was hesitant to equate form and formlessness entirely with rupa and arupa, which is the Buddhist way of doing it. Because as he points out, form can also be the form of mind and the form of the life energy. These also have forms, and these forms also belong to the same kind of duality of the infinite formless that can assume any number of forms. And he ends that paragraph by talking about the noumen and the noumen. That is, that these self-appearances are a combination of qualities and henceforth can be named, can have names. But these names, as he says, the names of the gods are the sum total of the qualities, powers, and character of being, the idea, or the noumen of that particular self-presentation of the divine. That part where he talks about this is also very interesting, because as he says, name in its deeper sense is not the word by which we describe the object, but the total of power, quality, character of the reality which a form of things embodies, and which we try to sum up by a designating sound, a knowable name, noumen. Noumen in this sense, we may say, is noumen. The secret names of the gods are their power, quality, character of being, caught up by the consciousness and made conceivable. And it is this idea that ultimately leads to the whole notion of the mantra, particularly the mantra of Nama Japa, the repetition of the name of God, a name like Krishna, for example, or a name like Ma, for example, would be not merely a sound, but actually become the sound body for the sum of qualities that that particular name represents, the noumen, or idea of the infinite presenting itself in that form. So here is, in that way, form and the formless are, complementarities, two sides of the same. In the Indian tradition, there is another way by which this has been shown, and that is through the Vishwarupa experience in the Gita. So in the Gita, we find this experience where Krishna is, shows to Arjuna his supramental form. And this is essentially something which unites the formless and the plenitude of forms. It is illogical. The mind cannot completely comprehend it. And this is the reason why it tears at the sense of sanity of Arjuna. And he cries out to be spared from this vision at a certain point. And Sri Aurobindo makes the comment in his essays on the Gita that Arjuna can't take it beyond a certain point because he has not really been prepared for this. And the preparation for this, the building of the degrees of perception leading to the perception of the infinite form in which formlessness and the plenitude of forms coexist is part of the yoga towards the supermind, the supramental yoga, to develop the degrees of consciousness that can see at once the formless and the plenitude of forms that it subtains.
So I have a question about this Sribindo's notion of name and nomen here.
Sure.
In certain science fiction literature, there's the idea of the secret name, or the true name, in which is different from the name that one goes by in society. And it, which has power, if one shares that name, one shares the kind of the essence of the being, and it's possible to have power over, say, a plant or something like that if you know the true name. And then in Native American tradition, there's a sense that in some languages that the name is not an arbitrary sound, it's just arbitrarily depends on what culture but is actually an expression of the being or the object that's named. And I wonder if what Sherbino is saying here has any connection to that or any, is a background for any of that kind of thing.
Yes, John Robert. Yeah, I believe that's exactly what he's saying, because this is a truth of occultism universally, that to know the secret name of a being, particularly an occult being, is to have power over it. And this, in fact, is how occultists operate, to capture spirits, as they say. So over here, even in what you talked about, the Native American traditions, in all ancient traditions, there has been the idea that the giving of a name is a significant act. It is one of the most important namkaran. The giving of the name is something which invokes a certain body of qualities into the person. And the secret name, as you're speaking of, even in Indian traditions, there are certain names that are astrologically received. In other words, they can they pertain to the significant qualities that are present at the birth of that person. And these names, once made public, once given to the person, become also an invocation. As you can see, a person is called by a name, and hence, in calling that name, one is actually calling on the body of qualities that that name represents, and in a sense, investing the person with that, with those qualities. So, in this particular way, I think the relation between the noumen and the nomen is valid, even if in a dilute form in today's culture, but to some extent, depending on the person and the usage of it, it certainly has a magical and occult property.
Thank you.
Debashish, you mentioned iconism, and I thought you were getting ready. I thought you mentioned a word to contrast that with, but maybe I missed something.
I didn't catch one word that you said, Mateo. What? Can you repeat your last sentence? There was one word that got.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, you used the term iconism and you talked about that, and I thought you used another word to juxtapose that with, but I did. Yeah. I thought maybe I missed something.
Yeah. The other word I used was an iconism. So these two terms, iconism and an iconism, are used in anthropological literature and particularly in art historical literature to refer to traditions of art making, which privilege form, and then there are those traditions that strictly deny the use of forms. So iconism, of course, in a kind of a loose way, is the making of any kind of object with a form to endow some significance to any kind of object or any kind of idea by giving it form. But in a more strict sense, iconism, of course, is idol making. Making a certain object and investing it with divine power. An iconism is the opposite. Now, monotheistic religions or Abrahamic religions have tended to be an iconic because they privilege the formless over the world of forms. And so because they make a trenchant divide between the infinite and the realm or domain of the finite, one becomes the domain of the creator, the other becomes the creation. And they make that divide in such a way that it becomes impossible for them to be bridged, so that one you always sees oneself as separate from and different from inferior to a transcendental infinite. And so from a certain point of view, it becomes very intolerant towards the bridge between the world of the formless and the world of forms, and calls upon the destruction of any forms that may represent or want to represent the infinite. That is an iconism in the strict anthropological religious studies sense. This has led, of course, as you know, to a lot of violence and suffering in the world, and continues, in fact. I mean, even today, I mean, recently, over the last few days, we've been hearing about the destruction of forms by, the ISIS, for example. And that kind of thing has happened throughout the ages. spiritually speaking, again, we have the same kind of, you know, problem. It's a problematic area where it is a truth, no doubt, that the transcendental has to transcend all forms. But at the same time, if one makes a fetish of it, then one creates a divide between the world of forms, which is the creation, in which finites have been, are the self-appearances, one may say, of the infinite. This particular case, if one privileges one over the other, then one finds that there is a certain kind of effect, you know, which is what in contemporary philosophers have called the totalitarian nature of metaphysics. In metaphysics itself, which privileges the one over the many, there is a certain totalitarianism, because from the domain of the many to posit the one that stays outside of the many is to set up some kind of an authority that is going to speak in the name of the one and be superior to the many. This is, you know, a certain kind of grave problem which people have recognized, thinkers have recognized as the root of fascism that is closely connected with religions. So in a way, what Sri Aurobindo is doing over here is forcing us to consider these dualities at the same time, not bereft of its other, in other words. So it's always keep in mind the dual nature, the complementary nature of these oppositions, as he says, that because that is the truth, and the truth is not either or, but both as sides of the same. So if there are no more questions or comments, we can move on to the next one. It becomes clear from these considerations. And Dan, would you like to read this one?
Sure. It becomes clear from these considerations that the coexistence of the infinite and the finite, which is the very nature of universal being, is not a juxtaposition or mutual inclusion of two opposites, but as natural and inevitable as the relation of the principle of light and fire with the suns. The finite is a frontal aspect and a self-determination of the infinite. No finite can exist in itself and by itself. It exists by the infinite and because it is of one essence with the infinite. For by the infinite, we do not mean solely an illimitable self-extension in space and time, but something that is also spaceless and timeless, a self-existent, indefinable, and illimitable, which can express itself in the infinitesimal as well as in the vast, in a second of time, in a point of space, in a passing circumstance. The finite is looked upon as a division of the indivisible, but there is no such thing, for this division is only apparent. There is a demarcation, but no real separation is possible. When we see with the inner vision and sense, and not with the physical eye, a tree or other object, what we become aware of is an infinite one reality constituting the tree or object, pervading its every atom and molecule, forming them out of itself, building the whole nature process of becoming, operation of indwelling energy. All of these are itself, are this infinite, this reality. We see it extending indivisibly and uniting all objects so that none is really separate from it or quite separate from other objects. It stands, says the Gita, undivided in beings and yet as if divided. Thus, each object is that infinite and one in essential being with all other objects that are also forms and names, powers, noumens of the infinite.
So here, this very interesting paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is actually giving us the phenomenology of this kind of experience. Because he's pointing out that this is not merely something that we need to just think about, but that dwelling on this idea, we will arrive at an experience. This is the point that he's making over here, and it's a very profound point, and it relates to the notion that he has introduced, that depending on how we see or how we hold ideas, we arrive at experiences. And what he's pointing to over here is that the need for seeing the universe as a set of finite instances and of conceiving of an infinite which is outside of those finite instances is a falsehood of our normal phenomenology. And this phenomenology is arising because of the nature of the evolving consciousness that moves from a density of individual self-appearance to a kind of, you know, to a recognition and identity with the Infinite One in all its instances. And so that is the desideratum. That is what is desired of us. And that's the preparation that we were talking about earlier. The preparation towards the supramental vision takes place through the holding at the same time of these two ideas, the oppositions that he has introduced. If we keep our focus on that, not merely take it as a kind of, a sort of thing to think about once in a while, but to dwell on it in our everyday life, then this affects our experience, and even our sense experience is affected by it. This is the point he's making very tellingly, and he actually describes something that he has himself experienced and talked about elsewhere. We find that Sri Aurobindo in some of his writings has described what he was experiencing in the Alipur jail. And at that time particularly, he was putting into practice, because if you remember, he had the Nirvana experience in which everything became unreal to him. Year before, he was incarcerated for 1 year at the Alipur jail. But during that year, he practiced, within that condition, he practiced systematically the holding of the idea that all this is the Brahman. That particular phrase was the idea that he practiced in his perceptions. And he claims that this exactly, I mean, he writes about it differently in a few places, but specifically with looking at things like trees, doors, people, the bars of his prison, the walls, he came to a perception in which he saw the One modulating itself into all these things, and there being a continuity between all these. These are all substantial modifications of the unitary substance. which has infinite qualities, and so there are also qualitative modifications and limitations. So that's why he has that description. When we see with the inner vision and sense, and not with the physical eye, a tree or other object, what we become aware of is an infinite one reality, constituting the tree or object, pervading its every atom and molecule, forming them out of itself, building the whole nature, process of becoming, operation of indwelling energy. All of these are itself, are this infinite, this reality. We see it extending indivisibly and uniting all objects so that none is really separate from it or quite separate from other objects. It stands, says the Gita, undivided in beings and yet as if divided. So this experience of containment, of the self-extension of the One, as the infinite being that has become all beings, is one aspect of this bridging between the many and the one. Yet it is not the only aspect. This is also one particular aspect. It's the aspect of extension. This is one way of experiencing what Sri Aurobindo says, seeing the Brahman in all things, so seeing everything as Brahman. The other way is to see that that one is completely present in each of its self-appearances. See, that experience also he was to have, the experience of individual immanence. This is the this is the experience of universal immanence, that there is nothing but the One that has become all things. So this is the way in which he's pointing to the possibility of our experiencing this reality of complementarity through our senses, through our very senses.
May I actually read like two lines from the chapter Matter?
Yeah, please.
It says, as mind is only, the page 250, it's some chapter Matter. It's just these two lines anyway. It's on the PDF version, it's null. Page 250 says, as mind is only a final action of supermind in the descent towards creation and life, and action of conscious force working in the conditions of the ignorance created by this descent of mind, so matter, as we know it, is only the final form taken by conscious being as a result of that working. Matter is substance of the one conscious being, phenomenally divided within itself by the action of a universal mind, a division which the individual mind repeats and dwells in, but which does not abrogate or at all diminish the unity of spirit or the unity of energy or the real unity of matter.
Yeah, indeed. That's wonderfully put, and indeed, in the case of the Upanishads, they point out that by the tapas of Purusha, our senses have been turned outwards. As they say, the senses are fastened with their doors outwards, and this is part of the way by which the reality is perceived by us. This is the self-multiplication of the properties of universal mind, so that we dwell in a certain way upon reality and receive it in a certain way. It's the action of Maya. It's the totality of the way in the mechanism of Maya is constituted. But that's exactly why he's pointing out that though this is the way that from the viewpoint of the Purusha, there is a point of time, particularly when we reach the human life, that it is possible to overcome or override the mechanism of nature, of Prakriti, and to assume other forms of perception than what is given by universal mind. And that exactly is part of this chapter where he's going to lead us to think about Purusha and Prakriti as a duality in which Purusha is controlled by Prakriti, but can regain control over Prakriti or the laws or automatisms of nature, of Maya, that have kept things in a certain appearance. And in overriding that, can arrive at other forms of experience, ultimately at forms of experience that belong to the other pairs, Ishvara and Shakti, and Brahman and Maya, and be fully cognizant of the one that is self-appearing as the many. So, Mateo, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sure. This incoercible unity in all divisions and diversities is the mathematics of the infinite, indicated in a verse of the Upanishads. This is the complete, and that is the complete. Subtract the complete from the complete is the remainder. For so too it may be said of the infinite self-multiplication of the reality that all things are that self-multiplication. The one becomes many, but all these many are that which was already and is always itself, and in becoming the many remains the one. There is no division of the one by the appearance of the infinite, for it is the one infinite that appears to us as the many finite. The creation adds nothing to the infinite. It remains after creation what it was before. The infinite is not a sum of things. It is that which is all things and more. If this logic of the infinite contradicts the conceptions of our finite reason, it's because it exceeds it and does not base itself on the data of the limited phenomena, but embraces the reality and sees the truth of all phenomena in the truth of the reality. It does not see them as separate beings, movements, names, forms, things, for that they cannot be, since they could be that only if they were phenomena in the void, things without a common basis or essence, fundamentally unconnected, connected only by coexistence and pragmatic relation, not realities which exist by their root of unity and, so far as they can be considered independent, are secured in their independence of outer or inner figure and movement only by their perpetual dependence on their parent infinite, their secret identity with the one identical. The identical is their root, their cause of form, the one power of their varying powers, their constituting substance.
So this beautiful, very powerful paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is bringing it all together and pointing to how the one has become the many. And in becoming the many, it actually has not changed itself at all. It is not a creation as such. The one was always many. The one is many. That is part of its oneness. It is never less many when it is one. So here, this kind of reality and perception is something which leads to a different consequence for our everyday existence, because the experience of otherness is also an experience of identity. This is exactly what is the consequence of this particular paragraph. And because it is an experience of identity, it is an experience of the play of identity in difference. And that is the play of delight. Out of the radical freedom of infinity, which is possessed by the one, arises the play of the one as the many. Because there is a radical difference, radical otherness between each of the irreducible specificity to each of the many, which at the same time is nothing other than the one, the boundaries, the horizons without limit of the one. This leads to very profound consequences, even philosophically and existentially. And he points to one of those consequences in that, towards the end of that paragraph, where he's talking about the fact that, that in case, if we were to talk about, the many that coexist, that are separate, that don't have a one that is behind them, something like a radical pluralism without a monism behind it, then we come up with a different kind of reality. And that's why he's saying a reality which is based in the void. It's a very interesting little passage in that paragraph, because it points exactly to a certain kind of philosophical outlook which belongs to the Madhyamika form of Mahayana Buddhism, which is called codependent arising. Codependent arising. So here you see, he says, it does not see them as separate beings, movements, names, forms, things, for that they cannot be, since they could be that only if they were phenomena in the void, things without a common basis or essence, fundamentally unconnected, connected only by coexistence and pragmatic relation. That is coexistent arising, you see. Are not realities which exist by their root of unity, and so far as they can be considered independent, are secured in their independence of outer or inner figure and movement only by their perpetual dependence on their parent infinite, their secret identity with the one identical. So here is where the big difference lies, that a reality which is arising codependently is a reality of plural instances in the void without anything connecting them. If one falls, all fall, and it all disappears into the void. And that kind of reality, to posit that kind of philosophical reality, you see, one thing to be understood or realized is the place of philosophy in the Indian systems. The place of philosophy is one of contemplation towards realization. To hold a philosophical idea is an existential path towards realization. And hence, all these descriptions of reality are never taken to be absolute. They are taken to be practical. They are forms of praxis. So if one is to take that kind of a view and hold that kind of a view in the mind, it is very useful to lead to a realization of the void, a realization in which the codependent arising can be broken, can be made to lose its sense of holding together. But on the other hand, if the idea conception which we hold in our minds has to do with the one that has become these infinite, then it is the significances of the one, the qualitative infinity of the one, that is self-presented in the other. And in relating to the other, it is the one to which we relate. See, so this makes a very big difference, and because it leads to the play of delight, the leela of the one, which is the significant reality in which we live.
Debashish?
Yes, Margaret.
I was just wondering, because they are so different, these two ideas and contemplations to realization, I'm sure there are places where there are dialogues between the two. Is there any one that you found particularly illuminating where these two are represented in a dialogue that maybe even brings out some connection between them or some exchange that they're not so distinct and holding to their own position?
Yeah, Margaret. Actually, there is a lot of middle ground between these two, what I spoke about as the codependent school of codependent arising, or other schools of Buddhism, and what Sri Aurobindo is saying about the one that has become the many. Actually, what I might say is, I mean, before talking about a dialogue, that these can themselves be stages in the experience of reality. And in fact, these themselves were stages in Sri Aurobindo's own experience of reality. Because remember, he starts with the Nirvana experience, in which everything becomes unreal. And in such a experience, that kind of transcendentalism, there is a loss of the glue that ties things together. And that is exactly how he experienced things for a long time. And it's only in the jail that what he calls the second status of the divine, which is the universal extension of Brahman, and the energy, the Shakti, that the one Shakti that has become all things, the universal Shakti, start making themselves evident to his experience. But this has only happened partly because Sri Aurobindo is not entirely convinced with the first realization that he has. He tells us that if it was to end with the Nirvana experience, there's a place where he says he would have felt it to be almost distasteful. And why would he say that? It's only because the aspiration is not fully satisfied. There is something in the aspiration that must be satisfied with the realization that we have. If it isn't, then we continue seeking for something else until that is reached. So we were talking about these two different schools, say Buddhism, or within Buddhism again there are different approaches, Mahayana and Theravada. But the codependent arising school is only one aspect of that. And in that aspect also there are many nuances, and there are different kinds of goals to which that is put. What I was going to say is that a great spokesman for Buddhism today is the Dalai Lama. And, I've heard him, say in so many words, he raised the question of, is there something that unites all Buddhists? He raised this question and he said, people say that it is the doctrine of no Atman and the doctrine of Nirvana being ultimately a void. And he said, let me tell you that is not universally held by all Buddhists. That there are Buddhists who will not admit that there is no Atman, and there are Buddhists who will not admit that there is no, that there is an ultimate void. So he said that these are all different, that part I really liked, where he said these are all different forms of ignorance. Whatever it is that we say about reality is the viewpoint of ignorance moving towards truth. once truth is realized, then one realizes that this was only a viewpoint. See, so from a certain point of view, we can look at it like that, and we can say that these are different ideas that orient us towards a certain realization or experience, and that if we create a kind of a middle ground of dialogue, we might very well find many different, a spectrum of different positions in between these two. And that has also happened, you know, because we do have many different schools, some of the Zen schools, some of the schools of Vajrayana, which is the, you know, the Tantric Buddhism, that affirm a reality much greater than, there was a whole sect, which ultimately is part of the Tantric Buddhism of Tibet, where a transcendentalism and immanence are posited of the Buddha himself. So there are middle grounds and dialogues between these two, Margaret.
Thank you, Devashish. That was very helpful.
So, Keka, would you like to read?
Sorry, my mic was muted. Just one second. After that constituting substance, right, the identical to our notions?
Yes.
The identical to our notions is the immutable. It is ever the same through eternity. For if it is or becomes subject to mutation, or if it admits of differences, it ceases to be identical. But what we see everywhere is an infinitely variable fundamental oneness, which seems the very principle of nature. The basic force is one, but it manifests from itself innumerable forces. The basic substance is one, but it develops many different substances and millions of unlike objects. Mind is one, but differentiates itself into many mental states, mind formations, thoughts, perceptions, differing from each other and entering into harmony or into conflict. Life is one, but the forms of life are unlike and innumerable. Humanity is one in nature, but there are different race types, and every individual man is himself and in some way unlike others. Nature insists on tracing lines of difference on the leaves of one tree. She drives differentiation so far that it has been found that the lines on one man's thumb are different from the lines of every other man's thumb, so that he can be identified by that differentiation alone. Yet, fundamentally, all men are alike, and there is no essential difference. Oneness or sameness is everywhere. Differentiation is everywhere. The indwelling reality has built the universe on the principle of the development of one seed into a million different passions. But this again is the logic of the infinite, because the essence of the reality is immutably the same. It can assume securely these innumerable differences of form and character and movement. For even if they were multiplied a trillionfold, that would not affect the underlying immutability of the eternal identical. because the self and spirit and things and beings is one everywhere. Therefore, nature can afford this luxury of infinite differentiation. If there were not this secure basis which brings it about that nothing changes, yet all changes, all her workings and creations would, in this play, collapse into disintegration and chaos. There would be nothing to hold her disparate movements and creations together. The immutability of the identical does not consist in a monotone of changeless sameness, incapable of variation. It consists in an unchangeableness of being, which is capable of endless formation of being, but which no differentiation can destroy or impair or minimize. The self becomes insect and bird and beast and man, but it is always the same self through these mutations, because it is the one who manifests himself infinitely in endless diversity. Our surface reason is prone to conclude that the diversity may be unreal, an appearance only, but if we look a little deeper, we shall see that a real diversity brings out the real unity, shows it as it were in its utmost capacity, reveals all that it can be and is in itself, delivers from its whiteness of hue the many tones of color that are fused together there. Oneness finds itself infinitely in what seems to us to be a falling away from its oneness, but is really an inexhaustible diverse display of unity. This is the miracle, the Maya of the universe, yet perfectly logical, natural, and a matter of course to the self-division and self-experience of the infinite.
So, again, in this long and beautiful paragraph, Sri Aurobindo brings together the identical, the one, and the many, the different, and points to how the one is truly infinite in its essence. And it is this infinity that manifests. It's a very, very important point, because we tend to privilege the one over the infinite. This is our natural tendency, because we live in a fragmented state. We live in an existence which is disintegral and disintegrated. And hence, we try to formulate a oneness by trying to bring together this disintegrated condition into an integrated or into an integer. But in trying to formulate an integer out of the condition of finiteness in which we exist, we only end up creating partial finites, which we give the name of the one to. That is always not the reality. And this is why either that happens or we move towards what he calls the colorless one. The one which has no color, because there is a gulf between that and the many. That one and the many are exclusive, are separated. But if the one is in itself the many, if plurality exists, radical plurality exists in the one, because it is the infinite, That is the mathematics of infinity, which is different in quality from the mathematics of the finite, which dwells in instances and to which one is an instance. So this is the reason why he goes into so much detail in bringing our minds to that conception of noticing that these are coexisting realities in the one. The many exist within the one. The one is the infinite. So, since there's a short paragraph after that, maybe it'll be good to read that as well. Margaret, would you like to read that?
Okay. Okay, so that's for the Maya?
Yes, for the Maya of Brahman.
For the Maya of Brahman is at once the magic and the logic of an infinitely variable oneness. If indeed there were only a rigid monotone of limited oneness and sameness, there would be no place for reason and logic. For logic consists in the right perception of relations. The highest work of reason is to find the one substance, the one law, the cementing latent reality connecting and unifying the many, the different, the discordant, and disparate. All universal existence moves between these two terms, a diversification of the one, a unification of the many and diverse. And that must be because the one and the many are fundamental aspects of the infinite. For what the divine self-knowledge and all knowledge brings out in its manifestation must be a truth of its being, and the play of that truth is its lila.
So here in this short paragraph, Sri Aurobindo rounds up that concept, that idea. And here he's bringing in the notion of the logic of the infinitely variable oneness. And this is the essence of logic, one may say. The logic of an infinitely variable oneness is the essence of logic because it is the logos. That is the essence of logic. And it's very interesting that throughout this, the last few paragraphs, he has been insisting on this idea of the logic of the infinite and comparing it to the logic of the finite, because logic, as he brings out over here, is that which gives us the self-relations of the one. That is what builds a plane of consistency. It gives us a certain kind of united picture. There's another place where Sri Aurobindo says, the knowledge that unites is the true knowledge. See? Ultimately, whatever knowledge we have is not complete until it is integrally united. That there is a knowledge in which the relations of the parts to the whole are clear. And so if there is to be an infinitely variable oneness, or we can think about it as an essence, a potential, which has got infinite potency. But we can also think about it as a spectrum that varies through a gradation, infinitely varying gradation of consciousness, and infinitely varying manifestation within the gradations of consciousness. So it is this kind of a system, one may say, that can manifest the totality in a coherent fashion, in a fashion which is logical. See, That is the infinitely variable oneness that he's referring to. And he's pointing to this fact because the one is many at the same time, but the many in the one can be put into relations in a certain way which is coherent. And this self-modulation of the one in a manifestation that is related and at the same time that is coherent deploys the logic of the one, deploys the logos, deploys the supermind. So that is the basis for what he calls the Leela of the infinite, the Leela of the divine, the play of the divine, the way by which the self-truths of the divine are self-manifest, put into order and put into relation. So that is a beautiful small summing up of the whole thing. He sums it up, as he says, by talking about the movement of the universal existence between the two terms, a diversification of the one and a unification of the many. See, and diverse. And it's really this, coexistence of the polarity of the one and the many, of repetition and difference, that constitutes the plane of consistency that we experience as the universe, that is the logic of the manifestation of the logic of the infinite. We have a few minutes left. If there are any questions, comments, I think it's not enough to go through another paragraph. The next paragraph is quite long. So, if there are any rounding up ideas, things that anybody wishes to comment on.
One comment about some of Sri Aurobindo's sonnets, like the sonnet, The Divine Hearing, and another one, Because Thou Art. They seem to be lyrical expressions of what this part of the life divine is, a philosophical expression.
Yes, no doubt. He has a number of them. There's also a divine sight, which are really talking about the way in which the senses can be transformed and perceive exactly what he's saying over here, the one and the many. And indeed, that is part of the invitation of these passages in terms of yoga and in terms of the openness to experience.
So, next class, Devashish, you will be out, right? I just wanted to bring up that before everybody goes.
I'd like to restate that. I stated it actually at the beginning of the class. So, the next class would otherwise have happened on the 14th of March. But I will be in transit, rather in transit that night. And so we will not have the next class on the 14th, but rather we'll have it on the next session on the 28th of March. So there will be about a month without any class. We'll resume on the 28th. So, okay, I think with that we can stop today and reconvene. I think today is a special day. It's the birthday of Auroville. And it's something that we can certainly keep in mind. The aspiration for human unity is what Auroville stands for. And again, that is again very similar to what we've studied today, which has to do with the perception of the one and the many. That is the very basis of the realization of human unity.
And it's 59 years since the supermental manifestation.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so with that, we'll get together again in a month's time. So see everybody then. Okay,
bye-bye. Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.